Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode is brought to you by our friends at ZipRecruiter, and we're lucky enough to welcome back to the podcast Tim Alberta, who is the author of the New York Times best-selling book American Carnage and the chief political correspondent for Politico magazine. So has your life returned to normal, Tim? I mean, yeah, this book thing.
It's getting there. It's getting there. I'm still reminded of my mortality and overall lack of importance by my family members and friends. So whatever high I was on, I came down from pretty quickly.
This is good because there are some of the, I think the default setting of the world is to humble us all, no matter what. So you just enjoy the whatever 15 hours of fame and success. So you're getting back into the routine. You said getting back to normal. Are we ever going to get back to normal? I mean, this is actually a serious question. Whether or not we're sort of trapped now in this time loop and we will never get back to anything approaching or what we thought was normal.
Yeah, so I'm actually very, very pessimistic on that question, Charlie, and people will sometimes sort of laugh about this, but I'm serious. Like, look, when I say a return to normal, it's like, you know, yeah, you know, spend time with your spouse, spend time with your kids, try and be active in your community and be civically involved. But you know, as a country and as a political ecosystem, is there any going back to normal? And my sense is that there's probably not, actually. I don't see any mediating institutions that have the capacity for lowering the temperature and bringing Americans back together. You know, like this morning, a lot of us will see that great video posted by Ellen DeGeneres where she talked about
the best thing. Yeah.
Yeah, it's great. And she talks about, you know, sitting next to George W. Bush at the Cowboys Packers game over the weekend and how, you know, Twitter went nuts. And she's kind of rebuking everybody gently, saying, look, like, be friends with people who don't agree with you. Be kind to people who don't agree with you. Be kind to everybody. I mean, this is not rocket science, right? And so we'll all watch that and people will, you know, approve and they'll share it on their social media. But then later in the day, they'll encounter somebody who disagrees with them and they'll sort of block them out reflexively, right? And turn a cold shoulder to them because they don't agree with them politically and culturally and otherwise. And I just don't know. In the age of constant news and a flood of information and social media and everybody working off of a different baseline of facts, how we can bridge some of these emerging divides and sort of get back to a place of at least, you know, civility in our political disagreements. I just, you know, people think that this is going to magically return to normal when Donald Trump leaves office, and I just don't think that's the case.
No, I tend to agree. By the way, the best thing about the Ellen DeGeneres video is her revelation that she was a Packer fan.
Yeah,
and that she was willing to go to Cowboy Stadium, but still rooting for the Packers, who are 4-1, and really, you know, it was rather impressive. No, it was interesting over the weekend because I think I tweeted out at one point the thread from somebody named, I don't know, I shouldn't even mention him, but somebody named Parker Malloy, who just went off on how totally awful it was that, you know, how can Ellen DeGeneres sit next to this this evil conservative Republican war criminal, George W. Bush, and the thread went on for some time. And of course, then joined in by the usual suspects, pointing out how evil George W. Bush is and how, you know, all Republicans are evil and we should never sit with them. We should never be nice to them. We certainly shouldn't be kind to them. And what the hell is Ellen DeGeneres thinking about that? And it was one of those reminders of what Twitter has become, but also what our political world. And then you had this grace note of Ellen DeGeneres coming out and saying, hey, you know, maybe this is a good thing. Maybe we should be kind to people we disagree with. And you're right. It is sort of a feel good moment that we're all talking about today. But we're going to revert to the norm, you know, by noon.
Yep.
On all of this, we're going to just simply revert to the norm that you know, we don't have to talk to you. There are no swing voters. There's no one persuadable. The only thing we can do is find a really large dirty cudgel and, you know, pound the other side into oblivion.
Yeah, and you know, the thing is, I talk about a lack of mediating institutions, and what does that even mean? Look, there is no shortage of talk in the American political argument about the way that congressional districts are drawn and gerrymandering and the political malfeasance that is inherent to sort of, you know, dividing and conquering the electorate based on partisan motivation. But Charlie, what most people don't recognize or appreciate is that counties in America are actually clustering geographically and demographically and ideologically faster than congressional districts are. And there's no way to really the point I'm making is that Americans are self-selecting in a way that they never have before. And, you know, if I were to sit down with you and we were to go over a litmus test of, you know, 20 demographic indicators, you know, what your favorite beer is, where you went to school, what kind of car you drive, what your favorite sitcom is, where you buy your groceries, et cetera, et cetera. We could nail down to an uncannily accurate degree where you are in the political spectrum and what issues motivate you and who you're going to vote for. And those things didn't necessarily used to be all those indicators that campaigns and super PACs and advocacy firms, all that intelligence they gather on us, on voters, on citizens, those things didn't used to be determinative to the degree that they are now about one's ideology or one's political affiliations. But they are now to such a great extent that, you know, campaigns don't even spend money or time trying to persuade in the way they used to. It's all mobilization all the time. And obviously, that's just looking at it through a political lens. But I think the cultural impact of that is just really profound. And I don't know, like in a community, how you can sort of attempt to bridge a divide if everybody you're living around and everybody you're interfacing with in your community believes the same thing that you do.
Okay, this is you've hit one of my hot buttons. I was an early adopter of the book The Big Sort, and in a certain sense, Wisconsin was a leading indicator of this in terms of the sorting out. You know, I'm living in what is known as one of the WOW counties. You know, Waukesha, Ozaukee, Washington County, which is one of those early indicators where these counties were becoming incredibly red. You know, Milwaukee County was becoming incredibly blue. You go to Madison, and you know, you could throw a rock down State Street, and you're not going to hit a Republican. You go to Waukesha, and you're not going to be able to find many liberal Democrats. I am, of course, exaggerating. So, you know, the fact is that this sorting has now escalated, and you have it on social media, where it's most obvious. But this physical geographic sorting has just accelerated. So, do people, you know, what is driving it? Because when people are deciding where do you want to live, honey. You don't look at who won the last governor's election. You don't look at the polls. You know, people don't consciously say, I want to live in an area where there are Republicans or Democrats. So what is it a cultural, is it a tribal thing? Is it all of these just sort of this clustering of attitudes and lifestyle that's leaching out into politics?
You know, I think it's so... With the obvious caveat that I'm not a social scientist and I don't even play one on TV, let me take a crack at it, which is to say that, and I talk a little bit about this in the book, you know, I think part of the problem here, Charlie, is that the lines have blurred between the political and the socioeconomic and the cultural, the distinctions that one would have made. I mean, I was sort of getting at this a minute ago with some of those indicators, some of those quantifiers that you know, political intelligence firms can sort of gather on voters. You know, when they're talking about, like, do you want to live near an interstate? Do you want to live near a Walmart? Do you want to live near a Whole Foods? Those things could have once been viewed sort of in a vacuum as far as what the implications would be for your lifestyle, right? But now they're, I think, sort of inexorably interconnected with, you know, like really explicitly political and ideological trends. And with that comes, you know, so like tribalism, we talk a lot about tribalism in a political context, but I think tribalism sort of transcends politics at this point, and in a lot of ways kind of informs almost every aspect of American life.
What TV shows we watch, where we shop for food, all of those sorts of things.
Absolutely. I mean, like Dave Wasserman everything. I mean, right, exactly. Like if you went and found 100 people who drive a Ford F-150, my hunch would be that at least 2/3 of them would identify as conservative Republicans, right? And if you went and found 100 people who drive a Toyota Prius, my hunch is that probably 3/4 of them or more would identify as liberal Democrats. And, you know, Dave Wasserman at the Cook Political Report has this great exercise he does with every presidential election where he sorts out the percentage of counties won by each candidate and then aligns them with counties that have a Cracker Barrel versus counties that have a Whole Foods store. And the break there, he calls it the culture gap between what the percentages of a Democrat who can win in a whole, in a Cracker Barrel county versus a Republican who can win in a Whole Foods county. And that divide, it was like, I think it was like 25 points or something back when Oh, yeah. Like, wait, but it's only grown. Like, it was, I think it was like 25 points, and I'm a little off on this, but when Clinton beat H.W. Bush, and by the time Trump beat Hillary Clinton, I think it was almost 60 points, and it's grown in every 4 year period. And so, again, like, how do you stop those trends? How do you hope to reverse any of this? I just don't know that you can.
No, it's I think I was on a television show with somebody who was explaining his district as a place where there were several dollar generals. And that this was the key thing you needed to understand, that if you weren't comfortable, you know, going to a dollar general, or if you don't know what a dollar general is, you're probably not going to do well. I think it was a Democrat running for Congress in Iowa. And again, all of this, I think, is accelerating. And that's why I'm concerned. And all of this, again, is magnified by being on Twitter and being on Facebook and seeing that, you know, that drumbeat. At a certain point, you just tune it out. Okay, so I want to talk about the state of play we're at right now. We have some stunning new numbers on impeachment, but some very, very conflicting signals. I want to talk about what the Republicans are saying about impeachment, what the Democrats are saying about impeachment, and also this very interesting phenomenon of Republicans rallying around Trump when it comes to the Ukraine issue, but willing to break with him on Syria. But first, before we do that, I want to hear a word from our sponsors. Today's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring can be a slow process. Cafe Altura's COO, Dylan Miskowitz, needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company, but he was having trouble finding qualified applicants. So he switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job, so you get qualified candidates fast. Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants so he could focus on the most relevant ones. And that's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/Bulwark. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Bulwark, B-U-L-W-A-R-K, ZipRecruiter.com/Bulwark. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right, we're back with Tim Alberta from Politico magazine. All right, so what do we make of the state of play? There is these absolutely stunning numbers from the new Washington Post survey that says 58% of Americans support the impeachment inquiry, 49% actually support removing Trump from office, 38% oppose the inquiry, and it also would suggest that there's been a dramatic move in public opinion, including among Republicans. I mean, if you believe this poll, 29% of Republicans are supportive of the quote unquote inquiry. So where are we at right now? What is the state of play? And I also see in the Politico newsletter that Republicans are passing around numbers showing, yeah, it's not so bad. The public doesn't like the idea of impeachment. So where are we?
Yeah, so I think it's time for everybody to take a really deep breath and understand that we're probably going to see a lot of polling numbers in the weeks to come, and that you know, this post poll, while it does contain some eye popping figures, it's one poll, and you know, it's always this is a well worn cliche at this point, but it's very much worth reminding everyone that, you know, polling averages matter a lot more than individual polls. That having been said, you know, if you're in the White House this morning and you wake up and see those numbers in the post survey, you are breaking into hot sweats. There's no way to dismiss, even if it is just one poll, and even if it winds up being an outlier, there's no way to dismiss a poll that shows nearly a third of Republican voters being open to an inquiry, and I think it was 20% of Republican voters in that poll saying that they support removal from office. I mean, even if it, I'm guessing the margin of error is like 4.5% or 5 on that poll. But even if you're way outside the margin of error, I mean, even if you're at, you know, one in every 15 Republican voters saying that they're now moving towards being in favor of removal from office, I mean, that's a huge problem. I don't need to remind everyone that this is a president who won the Electoral College by 3 states, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and a combined 77,744 votes in those states. So this is not someone, contrary to some of the conventional wisdom inside the Beltway that he is a political juggernaut, this is not somebody who has a whole lot of margin for error heading into his reelection campaign. So if you are staring down those poll numbers, forget about what Democrats are saying, and even forget about what independents are saying. You cannot win reelection if you're Donald Trump without the total and unified support and mobilization of the Republican base. And that includes, you know, suburban moderates who held their nose 4 years ago and pulled the lever for you because they wanted tax cuts or Supreme Court justices or whatever. So I think that that's the big takeaway from seeing those post numbers. You know, look, I think it was highly predictable that Democratic voters, Democratic partisan voters and independents would, we'd see a big swing in their numbers once more Democratic lawmakers came out for impeachment. I think obviously the dam burst a couple of weeks ago, and it was understandable to see those big swings. As far as the internal numbers the House Republican leaders are sharing with some of their members, Charlie, you know, I would just note the caution there too. I've talked with House Republicans, I've talked with high-level staffers close to leadership. They are not confident at all in where they are right now. They're not liking what they're hearing back home. Now, that's not to say that suddenly you're going to see some dramatic exodus of Republican lawmakers defecting from Trump and voting to open an impeachment inquiry. I don't think you're going to see that necessarily. But there is a lot of nervousness, much more even than you felt during the Kavanaugh episode or during the Mueller investigation. There's a lot of nervousness because the president has sort of put himself out there and essentially owned this thing and said, yeah, I did it. So what? I'll do it again. And that's what's making a lot of Republicans very nervous behind the scenes, that if he's already willing to sort of take that step, what else might he be willing to do as this process unfolds?
Yeah, there's the King Lear theory that's out there that you know, as he's more besieged, he's going to lash out even more, become more panicky. So you can't really be confident. So this whole phenomenon of what Republicans say in public and what they say in private has always been interesting. I think was it Jeff Flake who suggested that if there was a secret ballot, there might be 30 Republicans that might vote to remove the president. I don't know whether that's true or not. So have you noticed has there been a shift in the way that elected office holders talk about Trump? You know, you say they're more nervous. Are they just simply nervous that it's bad politics, or are some of them going, oh, my God, you know, what would another half decade of Trump in the White House mean for America?
So based on my conversations with lawmakers and with high level staff, Charlie, it seems that the big concern is what you got at a minute ago with the King Lear theory, that the president might be beginning to unravel a bit, that his capacity for self-inflicted wounds is not yet fully realized, and that this is someone who, if he begins to feel the walls closing in, that he could lash out in a way that is destructive, not just to him, but to the entire party. You know, it seems like ancient history now, but, you know, Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell and Reince Priebus in the fall of 2016, these guys feared a complete and utter annihilation of the Republican Party, right? I mean, they were crunching all the numbers from the RNC, from the NRSC, from the NRCC, and they were staring down the barrel of what they thought was a complete Democratic takeover in the fall of 16, because Trump had just basically torpedoed the ticket up and down. Now, as it turned out, Trump wound up, you know, beating Hillary Clinton by that narrow margin, and he did so despite running behind a number of senators in those tough battleground states, you know, Ron Johnson, among others, in your state of Wisconsin. So it's easy to forget that now. But I think what a lot of Republicans fear is that if Donald Trump really does begin to unravel, and if this thing goes south in a hurry, whether he's removed from office or not, whether he's impeached or not, that they've got, you know, 13 months left to run in this race, and that that's an awfully long time to be out there on a limb defending a president who's not doing much to defend himself.
You mentioned Ron Johnson, and I think you know a little bit of the background here. You know, I've known Ron John for years. I played a role in his getting elected, and I've always really liked him. I've respected him. I know how he thinks. I have some insight into it. And I got to say, I was just gobsmacked by how cringeworthy that appearance on Meet the Press was. And I'm looking at this and going, you know, this is part of the Trumpian corruption of Republicans, because here is this common sense, reasonable businessman from Oshkosh who somehow now has been deranged by his Trump defenses. And it's painful to watch. And I wonder whether other Republicans are watching the Jim Jordans and watching Ron Johnson and going, is this what it's going to be like for the next year? Do I have to go and do that? Or do I have to put on one of these pathetic performances like Marco Rubio, you know, and pretend that everything's a joke? I mean, it's going to be complicated for them.
You know, complicated is putting it generously, right? I mean, and I think beyond that, Charlie, look, your question, I think the answer is yes. I mean, most of them will spend the next 13 months doing this. I think the bigger question is, you know, everybody asks, well, where does the Republican Party go after Trump, right? Well, what I want to know is, when we show these video clips to these individuals years from now, how will they react to seeing themselves, right? When Ron John is back in Oshkosh and he's retired and, you know, he's sitting on a small fortune and he's probably wintering down in Fort Lauderdale or whatever, right? And he's retired and doesn't want to talk about politics. Like, when you show him that video clip from Meet the Press on Sunday, what does he think? Like, I just don't know. I was with Bob Costa the other day on his PBS show, and he was asking me about, you know, the reckoning that will come for some of these Republicans, and have I experienced any of that in my reporting? And I said, honestly, the only bit of it that I've really experienced so far was with another Wisconsinite, with Paul Ryan, when he left office. And I sat down with him about 3 weeks after he'd retired, and we did this interview for the book that wound up making a lot of news. I could really sense in him that for the first time, he kind of had that benefit of hindsight, and that he was able to look back now with a different perspective because he was out of office, because he was back home, because he wasn't worried about re-election or worried about getting a phone call from the president, wasn't worried about his caucus and what they were going to say. And suddenly he was liberated and sort of able to elevate and see, boy, this is a mess. And what role did I play in it? So I have to think that, you know, maybe not for everybody, maybe not for the Mark Meadows and not for the Matt Gaetzes of the world, but for some of these folks, certainly some of the more thoughtful Republicans who have, as you said, kind of, you know, become so enslaved to this president in a way that makes them almost unrecognizable. You do have to think that there's going to be a reckoning for them, and it's going to be very unpleasant.
It is striking, though, and maybe we're naive to think that people should think in terms of how history will look back on them. But you do get to a certain age, and Ron John and I are roughly the same age, that you do start thinking about, what is your legacy? How are you going to be remembered? What was the point of all of this? And as opposed to being caught up in the news cycles, and, you know, being caught up in, you know, in the day to day hand to hand combat, but there's not a lot of introspection, and it is going to be painful for some of these folks. Okay, speaking of some of these folks and painful, Lindsey Graham had a very bad day yesterday, didn't he?
Ooh.
I mean, that was rough. I have a very unkind piece about him in your magazine today.
I read it.
You think about, he is sort of the ultimate of the Faustian bargain. I'm going to kiss up to Donald Trump. I'm going to play golf with him. I'm going to take his phone calls. I'm going to say nice things about him, because then I will be in the room and I will be able to stop the really bad stuff from happening. And then the bad stuff happens, and Lindsey Graham doesn't even get a text message, and it's like,
yeah, you get all of the Faustian, but none of the bargain,
right?
Right? Like, it's really difficult to imagine a scenario in which Lindsey Graham could do any more to ingratiate himself to Trump and do it in a way that is just, you know, humiliating and emasculating, and simultaneously receive less from Trump in terms of sort of return on that investment and you know, influence wielded over policy that Graham purports to really care about. As you said, it's not even like the president did something that broke with Graham or something that Graham was going to be unhappy about. He didn't even tell him. He didn't have a seat at the table. He wasn't able to make his argument and say, no, Mr. President, you know, listen to me on this. So, I mean, it's a reminder that you can do or say, you know, it's interesting, Charlie. I had this conversation with Bob Corker before he retired, the former senator from Tennessee. And you know, Corker had really had this nasty break with the White House where he had kind of stepped out eventually and threw up his hands and said that the president was, you know, was basically a kindergartner and that it was a daycare center at the White House and that this guy could start World War III, all these other things. And, you know, Corker said to me, he said, but it's interesting. You know, you would think that suddenly I would lose my direct line to the White House, but I could still get the guy on the phone anytime I wanted. And Corker said, you know, this is like crack to him. Like the guy, yes, you know, he'll blow up and he'll, and there'll be some dramatic falling out of relations. But then, you know, two or three days later, if you can do something for him, of course he'll take your call. Of course he'll tweet something nice about you. Like the guy, he's just unlike anybody else that we've ever worked with or ever, or, you know, serve alongside in politics in that regard, that these relationships are really all boiled down to what can you do for him? And if you have a utility to him, as Lindsey Graham has done in providing cover for all these things, then great. But ultimately, at the end of the day, Donald Trump is not going to factor in what Lindsey Graham has to say on most of these issues, because ultimately, Lindsey Graham is not Donald Trump's buddy. Lindsey Graham is just somebody who can do something for Donald Trump.
So let's talk about the blowback, because the, you know, across the board, it was really interesting watching how many Republicans push back on the president on Syria and how strong their language was. Mitch McConnell's statement, almost every single word was sort of a barbed arrow, you know, aimed at Trump and his brand about being tough. And people are wondering, well, there are folks who are not as dialed in as you are, who are going, well, okay, what's going on here? Is this some sort of a tipping point? Why are Republicans who have been had this wall of silence when it comes to Ukraine, why are they willing to break so openly with Syria? Does that mean anything? So can you explain the paradox of Republicans unwilling to say anything negative about the president when it comes to impeachment, Ukraine, China, but going all out and all in on attacking his decision to betray the Kurds?
Yeah, so I think you start with the basic distinction and then I'll broaden out from there. The basic distinction is that one is personal and one is policy. And that might sound a little fuzzy to people, but it's really important to recognize that, you know, anything on Ukraine or anything on Mueller or you know, these scandals, these crises that sort of threaten the, you know, the existence of Trump himself as a leader, as a president, as a political figure, those things are nuclear. They are radioactive for Republicans to go anywhere near, because that is the kind of thing that Trump will take very personally and that he will remember and that he will lash back out at you over, because he cares more about himself than he does about these policies. So if you are going to beat up, if you're going to come out and criticize the tariffs, right, odds are overwhelming that Donald Trump doesn't care, right? You know, because you're expressing a policy disagreement. If you're going to come out and yell and scream about the bailout of farmers, then Donald Trump's probably not going to care. He's not going to single you out on Twitter. He's not going to dox you. If you come out, as so many Republicans did over the last 24 hours, in opposition to his decision on Syria, he's not, if anything, he might actually, when there's this sort of a resounding chorus of opposition, he might even listen, right? But he's not going to lash out over it, because at the end of the day, Donald Trump doesn't really care about Syria. He doesn't care about the geopolitical implications in the Middle East. It's just not something that like keeps him up at night. What does keep him up at night is the fact that, you know, 50% of Americans in this new Washington Post survey think he should be impeached. Like, that bothers him. But, you know, he could see a poll today showing that 90% of Americans think he's dead wrong on Syria and on betraying the Kurds, and he would shrug his shoulders. So I think that's the basic distinction. Most Republicans in Washington recognize that they have to pick and choose their places where they can be in disagreement with the president. And something that's policy-based, and especially something that's foreign policy-based, I think they all recognize is probably the safest place for them to lodge a disagreement. This and that's so why so many of them have done it.
This is that was so great. And that is key. There's a real distinction between something that he regards as an existential threat that might involve regime change versus these issues, which, again, he's really not engaged in. So let's talk about Mitt Romney and the moment that he's having. Did you see the Gabriel Sherman piece in Vanity Fair?
I saw it tweeted about, but I'm not ready yet.
Yeah, I went through it. It struck me as perhaps overstating the case that Romney is, you know, is deciding that he's going to, you know, rally support for the president's removal. But, you know, just who right now is the most interesting member of the Senate that you're watching to see where we're going? Because I know you think all the time about, you know, where's the Republican Party going? What's going to happen? What is the post-Trump party going to look like? So who are you keeping your eye on right now?
So I am keeping my eye on the senator from Utah, but it's not the junior senator from Utah. I am really interested to see what Mike Lee has to say about all of this. Now, Lee is another figure who I think, you know, objectively one can look at and really scratch their head and say, geez, how can this guy who called for Donald Trump to drop out of the presidential race on the weekend of Access Hollywood, how can this guy who, you know, joined the rules committee at the convention in Cleveland and led the effort there on the rules committee to try and oust Donald Trump as the nominee at the convention. How can this guy who said that, you know, Donald Trump was basically unfit for office and immoral and all these other things, how can he then not only sort of go silent during the Trump presidency on all of his various offenses and behaviors, but actually in many ways become a reliable ally and provide cover for him in the way that Mike Lee has done? That is a question that nags at me. It's a question that nags at a lot of other people I know who kind of swim in these circles, Charlie. But Mike Lee, I don't know, in my mind, he is still sort of a wild card. He's still sort of a guy who, if he was the first one to come out and say, you know what, we've had enough, I will vote for impeachment, I will vote for removal, I just got to say, I wouldn't be shocked. And that's not to predict
really?
That he's going to.
Really?
It's not at all to predict that he's going to do it. But if there's one person in the Senate who fits the profile of a real, true, a conservative who is really principled and who could find themselves in a situation where they decide that they've had enough and that the consequences be damned, they're going to take that vote, then I think Lee is as good a candidate as any. And by the way, for many of the same reasons that we would assume that Romney is as good a candidate as any, because they come from a state where Trump is not popular. They come from a state where they are highly unlikely to lose in a primary because they've both sort of built their brands in a way and have their own kind of unique connections with the Republican electorate there. So Lee and or Romney could get away with crossing Trump in that way, in a way that I think nobody else could probably in the U.S. Senate.
That is fascinating. And I see that he's one of the few Republicans, though, right now, who is supporting the president's decision in Syria or the president's apparent decision in Syria. We're not exactly sure what is going to happen, but that. So, on the podcast yesterday, I was talking with Matt Lewis, and Matt is actually, I don't want to be. We just have a disagreement about this. I think he's trying to talk himself into thinking that there's a possibility there might be 20 senators who would vote to remove Trump, and I think that's irrational exuberance. I just don't. I can't count that high. And I do think that there's you know, a little excessive expectation given the track record that we've seen going into an election year, trying to imagine a large number of Republicans. So what is your take on that? Because, you know, one of the things that in the back of my mind, I'm thinking there has to be a critical mass. As long as it's just Mitt Romney, it's going to be just Mitt Romney. But what will it take if, in fact, it was Mitt Romney and it was Mike Lee, or if it was and Susan Collins came on board and then somebody like a Lamar Alexander? Is there a point at which the dam breaks?
Probably not. That
would be my answer, by the way.
We're living in the real world here. And as much as we could try to conjure up a scenario where, the dominoes fall one by one and these people sort of discover their conscience and discover their courage and they decide that, you know what, we've seen enough and this is the right move. And even if that means losing my seat and having death threats to my family and ruining my post-political career, then I'm still willing to do it because it's the right thing to do. Like, that's just not how most politicians
right.
operate,
as sad as
that is to say, right? And so, look, if I'm in Vegas right now, I'm setting the over-under at one half of a vote in the U.S. Senate on the Republican side to remove. And that's not one and a half, that's 0.5, right? So that's the over-under. I mean, I don't even know, Charlie, if I'd be willing to take the over. Mitt Romney has been a mercurial figure in the U.S. Senate, to put it generously. He has, I think, obviously spoken out at times and done so very gracefully and has been a leader in certain respects. But there have been other times where he has made decisions or done things that have puzzled people and left even allies of his kind of scratching their heads, wondering, you know, what his end game is. So, you know, Romney, I think, probably is the most likely to cast that vote. But at the end of the day, are we betting that he would cast it? I'm not sure that we are.
Yeah, it is uncertain. And Mitt Romney is sort of still standing alone. I had a piece yesterday, you know, Mitt Romney alone again. On the other hand, in terms of this verdict of history, you know, he is ideally positioned to be able to think right now that this is what happens now in the next 12 months is what is going to define him in history. He will be remembered for the stand he takes on all of this. This will define Mitt Romney's legacy. And when you're 70 years old and you're a multimillionaire and you have a 6-year no-cut contract and you're from Utah, you have a freedom to be able to think in those terms in the way that other members of Congress would not be able to do. So again, it's dangerous, but my sense is that he's growing into this role and that he understands the unique position he holds. But I would put the over under at one, but not above that. So Tim Alberta, anything else you're keeping an eye on this week that we get lost might get lost? The reason I ask that question is, and again, this is not a deep insight, that the news cycle is moving so fast that there are extraordinarily interesting stories that we don't even get to because the pace is so great. So is there anything else that you are watching or we should keep an eye on over the next several days?
Yeah, look, a few things. Obviously, we're seeing the news this morning about the EU ambassador not testifying in front of the House Intelligence Committee, which is real news, Charlie, because and obviously we're seeing reports that he was in touch with the White House, that he was in touch with the president personally during one of those text message exchanges that was unearthed during testimony last week before House Intel. Listen, this is really interesting on a number of levels, and I don't want to go way down the rabbit hole, but it gets back to some of what we saw with Trump during the Mueller investigation, which in hindsight is really puzzling because he was cleared in many respects what the worst case scenario might have been. But why act guilty is a question that a lot of us have had for this Trump White House. And this is, again, another occasion where we would ask it, why are you telling this guy not to go testify if you've got nothing to hide? If you believe that he's not going to implicate you, if you believe that there's not, you know, incriminating evidence that he is going to share, why tell him not to go? Because all you're doing is you have already asked Democrats to impeach you, and now you're begging them to impeach you. And look, there are people around the president who believe that impeachment is the golden goose. And so I don't want to dismiss at all the probability that the president wants to be impeached, that he thinks it's the best thing that could happen to him politically. And yet, if you're a House Democrat and you have subpoena power, you know, that subpoena power doesn't mean anything unless you're actually willing to put muscle behind it when people are defying you openly like this. And so this actually sets up a really, really interesting confrontation, not just between Trump and House Democrats, but between the executive and legislative branches. And we have seen the legislative branch become pathetically subservient to Democrat and Republican presidents over the last 20 years. And, you know, we're kind of waiting for this moment where the legislative branch can reassert itself. And I think this is a really interesting historical moment in that regard. So I think that's something that we have to keep an eye on. And then the other thing is, you know, not altogether unrelated, which is, what are these members hearing back in their swing districts? And Congress is on recess right now. There are only you know, probably 50 to 65 real swing districts left in the U.S. Congress. Most of these folks represent safe red or safe blue seats. But what are the vulnerable incumbents, Democrat and Republican, what are they hearing about back in their districts this week? And then how do they carry it with them when they come back to Washington next week? That is something that I'm keeping a really close eye on. I'm talking with a lot of members and with a lot of their chiefs of staff while they're back home, because I'm very interested in knowing what their constituents are saying to them.
What a fascinating conversation. Tim Alberta, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. And congratulations again on your outstanding book, American Carnage.
Hey, thanks for having me, Charlie. And I hope that you will have me back after the Lions beat the Packers on Monday night.
That could happen. That could happen. But then I could get a unicorn for my birthday as well.
So, or
you
of,
could, oh, I'm sorry, Vegas, you could get a unicorn.
Yeah, right. Well, speaking of Vegas, I don't think I'm going to go there and put any money on that one. But.
That would be a good life choice. Hey, and thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. Today's episode was brought to you by ZipRecruiter. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.